Good morning, Your Honors. Ms. Hahn, and may it please the court. My name is James Todd, and I'm here on behalf of appellant Mr. Carl Susan. Your Honors, we're not here today to ask this court to figure out how we got to the final amended judgment and decree. I certainly can't. Frankly, I don't think this record is procedurally confusing as it is, nor the district court's woefully inadequate findings are sufficient for this court to figure out exactly what the district court was thinking when it issued the final decree. But we are here because it's clear that the district court abused its discretion by issuing a final decree which effectively impoverishes Mr. Susan, both in requiring him to pay roughly 90% of his gross disability income in court-ordered support, and by saddling him with 100% of the federal income tax liability associated with the lost wages portion of his personal injury award.
Well, can I stop? Because I just want to make sure I understand what took place here. And I mean, because is there any dispute that the income coming from the disability annuity was that's treated as income, as an income stream, but that after he's 62, then the retirement kicks in and that becomes an asset? Is there any dispute on that?
Your Honor. There is no dispute on that particular point. What effectively happens is that the court has the option of treating Mr. Susan's disability benefit as either a stream of income for spousal maintenance purposes or as an asset to be divided. And I believe a respondent had argued at the district court level that it ought to be an asset to be divided. They're not appealing the district court's ultimate determination that it's income for spousal maintenance.
Now, here's my question, because there's some, is the permanent maintenance continued after age 62?
The decree is not clear on that point, Your Honor, and I think that's...
Because I couldn't tell from the order, and I don't know what the parties are...
Neither can I, Your Honor.
...taking a position on that.
Neither can I, and we're not taking a formal position on that issue as part of this appeal. It looks like it would end because of how the disability benefit was treated.
Is there anything in the order, though?
No, there is not.
Whether it ends or it continues... And if it continues, wouldn't that be a double dip?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It absolutely would be a double dip. And because of the language of the decree, I mean, that's another instance that we didn't brief of how the district court failed to adequately structure this overall order to protect Mr. Susan and frankly, Ms. Susan as well, because both parties would be required under this circumstance to file a motion for a motion to amend spousal maintenance once that disability income turns into the retirement asset, which is divided according to the court order acceptable for processing. Your Honors, what we're asking this court to do first is to reverse the district court's maintenance award and to remand this case back to the district court for a proper analysis of the factors of Minnesota Statute 518.552, including a consideration of whether Mr. Susan even has the ability to pay any amount of spousal maintenance under the current circumstances. Second, we're asking this court to remand to the district court with instructions for the district court to provide a workable mechanism for the ordered equal division between the parties of the ongoing monthly cost of the FERS survivor annuity protection. Third, we're asking this court to reverse the district court's order that Mr. Susan maintain the FEGLI life insurance, the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance Policy.
I want to understand that, too. Now, because as I read the order, that life insurance was put in because there was a fear that if your client died, that then the wife would be left without any rights to his retirement.
Correct. And that was...
And so are you conceding that at least was necessary up until the time that those retirement benefits kicked in?
Absolutely, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, you're not objecting to the life insurance, it's just the continued life insurance after 62?
No. Let me clarify.
I'm not sure I understand your argument.
when the district court first issued its order regarding Fegley Life Insurance, Mr. Susan hadn't yet received federal FERS disability benefits, disability or retirements. That application had been pending. So at that point in time, and that's when the respondent's expert, Joanna Clyburn, testified at trial, and at that point, he hadn't yet received those benefits. So there was the possibility, the distinct possibility that, you know, A, he wouldn't receive those benefits, B, that he might die between the time of trial and when he did get those benefits. And under those circumstances, Fegley Life Insurance was appropriate.
But you're saying benefits, are you talking about the disability benefits? Because we're talking about disability and retirement.
Correct. Well, we're
and as I understand it, there was a fear not only that, you know, he could die before the disability became available, but also when the retirement became available.
Well, let me clarify my point. Okay. When Mr. Susan was eligible for FERS disability benefits, he was also able to elect and maintain what's called the survivor annuity protection. And what that does is it gives Ms. Susan 50% of his benefit if he were to die, which effectively protects against spousal maintenance and child support.
But wasn't there a concern about that life insurance being available up until the point in time when he started getting retirement?
There is a concern that's articulated by respondent. And that is a concern that that is based on an erroneous assumption.
What is the erroneous assumption?
Well, the concern is that because Mr. Susan has to recertify to maintain FERS disability benefits and by proxy the FERS annuity survivor benefit, that if he were somehow not to recertify, or were to become ineligible because he's earning too much income, for example, which cuts against another argument that I'll hope to go into, then Ms. Susan would be then unprotected.
Well, and why is that erroneous?
Because it is exactly akin to saying there's a life insurance policy that protects Ms. Susan in place, hypothetically, let's say. And that protects her maintenance and child support. It would be just like the district court saying, we're going to order Mr. Susan to carry a second life insurance policy in the event that he fails to maintain the insurance premiums on the first policy and it lapses. Well, we've never seen a district court do that because it's duplicative and unnecessary. You don't require someone to maintain two life insurance policies for the same benefit in case they lose one of them. I mean, what the court could have done is say, if you become ineligible for FERS and you're not able to maintain the FERS survivor annuity benefit protection, then at that point you're required to immediately secure life insurance to replace it. But
he doesn't, and then something happens to him. Isn't that the fear?
Well, that is the fear, but that's not a fear that wouldn't be present in the hypothetical circumstance of having one life insurance policy. There's always the possibility that somebody's not going to pay the premiums on it and it's going to lapse. But the district court doesn't require them to maintain a second life insurance policy, securing the exact same benefit to insure against them the lapse of the first policy. So it is absolutely duplicative, and what we're really...
Well, counsel, I see where you're going with this in your analogy, but is it true that every year he has to reaffirm the disability status and there are ways that he could get kicked off of that?
I believe the only way he could get kicked off of it is if he doesn't have to continue to take medications which would preclude him from being an air traffic controller. Or he earns income that is so high that it effectively precludes him from being eligible for disability benefits. And what he has said is that, I mean, and frankly, the evidence in the record says that he's completely unable to work, and he's medically disqualified from being an air traffic controller.
He's medically disqualified from doing that kind of work because of the medication he's on, but he's certainly qualified to do other work, is he not?
Well, he may be qualified to do other work, but does not, the first, no, I actually, I'm sorry.
Does the first disability eligibility turn on his job as an air traffic controller, or does it relate more broadly to his inability to work?
It relates specifically to his inability to perform the job functions of an air traffic controller.
So he's entitled, one would qualify for that disability even though you could perform other jobs.
Correct.
Unless the income was of a certain level.
Unless he goes out and finds a job and earns income over and above a certain level.
Okay.
And that's another part of the problem here with the district court's order, because the district court did not make findings and did not analyze what Mr. Susan's financial circumstances were and whether or not he could meet the monthly maintenance requirement. And in fact, what you find when you analyze respondents' evidence is that if he were to go out, if he could work, which he can't, but if he could and he went out and got a job and earned a level of income that, say, filled the gap between where his disability income is now and what he would need to meet his own expenses and pay this extraordinarily high level of spousal maintenance, that might well disqualify him from federal disability benefits, putting him back in the hole. And so,
can I ask a question? One of your one of the issues that you've raised is a complaint about the division of cost of the survivor benefit, and your argument is that it wasn't taken into account during. Here's my question: is your argument limited to just when the disability benefit is an income stream? What happens to the cost of that survivor benefit when we switch into retirement and the parties are getting the division of their assets?
My understanding is that, Your Honor, is that the survivor benefit is no longer necessary because the retirement will have been divided when he is 62 under the terms of the COAP. The asset stream gets divided. So if Mr. Susan dies after 62, Ms. Susan still receives her pro rata marital portion of the retirement asset.
So your complaint about the division of the cost of that benefit is only during this period of time that it's pre-retirement. Is that right?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. And effectively, what's happened here is the court order acceptable for processing explicitly provides that the cost of maintaining this FERS annuity survivorship protection benefit shall be borne equally by both parties. But the district court doesn't provide a mechanism for that to happen. And indeed, what's actually happened is the Office of Personnel Management, who's now received a garnishment order post the decree, is just garnishing his wages and taking out far more than he could, leaving him with far less than he could possibly live on. And there isn't some mechanism by which Ms. Susan is now required to pay Mr. Susan, I think, like $295 a month, which is her 50% pro rata portion of the 10% cost of maintaining the FERS annuity protection. It's another example of the myriad ways in which I think the district court missed the mark here and abused its discretion. And the reason that we're appealing these issues is because they are all interrelated. They relate to his monthly cash flow. He is being impoverished by this court order. If this stands, he's going to have to sell his house. He's going to have to sell all of his possessions. He's going to be on the street. I mean, he cannot eat month to month and continue to pay this support order. And so what we're asking the court to do is to send this back for a redetermination of these issues because they are interrelated.
Well, could I ask you, was there any submission of his budget or the budget of the wife in this case, is what their needs were?
I don't know offhand, Your Honor. I don't. I believe that expenses were testified to on the stand, particularly Ms. Susan's expenses. But I don't believe that the district court really considered what Mr. Susan's expenses were. But the main point, and
but you don't
Your Honor,
know
I see
whether
my,
he presented that evidence?
I'm sorry?
But you're not sure whether he presented that evidence for the district court to consider?
No, Your Honor. And I see my time is running out. If I could finish my answer, I appreciate it. The main point is that it's largely irrelevant what his expenses are, because what he is left with at the end of every month is so low, and that's before he has to pay income taxes, $640 a month before income taxes, that no one could live on that. That's well below the federal poverty guidelines. I see my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mary Hahn. I'm here on behalf of Christina Susan, the respondent. There's a lot to cover. I was involved in this case with my partner from day one. The trial started in August 2017, and the final amended decree came out almost a year and a half later. I am going to try to touch on every point, and at the end of my discussion today, I'm going to ask the court to affirm the amended decree and the final decree and the amended final decree. There was no abuse of discretion. What I want to start with is scope. What is this court's scope of review? And I made this point strongly in my response brief that Mr. Susan failed to file post-trial motions, motions for amended findings or for new trial after the amended final decree. And those issues, pardon me, the issues that this relates to is his appeal of maintenance, the FERS annuity survivor benefit, the FAGLI, and the tax effect of personal injury award. Those four topics, he never gave the court a chance to flesh out its decisions and its order. Now, the effect of this is significant, as we know. And at Minnesota practice has summarized, this is 14 Min Proc under family law, if on appeal a party intends to challenge the lower court's failure to make a finding on a particular fact issue, a motion for amended findings is necessary to preserve the issue for appeal. A defect concerning a trial court's findings that is not brought to the attention of the trial court cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. So this is the overlay for this appeal.
Well, could I ask you this? Because, I mean, part of the argument that was made, at least in the briefing, and I think you would concede that there weren't any findings under the spousal maintenance statute that were made. I mean,
correct.
And so that there are no findings for us to review on this other than what we're able to glean from the record. But the court, there were disputed findings and there's nothing there. And it seems like you base your argument primarily on what you claim was a stipulated spousal maintenance amount.
One piece, for sure. Yes. Yes,
right.
Your Honor.
And I guess that kind of bothered me because first of all, it wasn't really a stipulated amount because they didn't agree on who paid the taxes, so there wasn't a stipulation. Am I correct? Because they never did agree on the final amount.
What happened, there was no agreement between the parties. You are absolutely correct, Your Honor. What happened was, at a hearing in October of 2018, Mr. Susan's counsel said he will agree, he will agree to pay $2,000 a month in spousal maintenance. And so it was we can call it an agreement, a concession, a statement on the record. However we want to define it, you are absolutely right. There was not a stipulation between the two parties.
Right.
So and, the court.
But you're saying that because he agreed to this, the court isn't required to make those findings or consider the criteria for an award of spousal maintenance.
There are several things going on here, and forgive me if I'm the court did not go through each of the statutory factors for maintenance. Absolutely correct. What we have, though.
But isn't that an error of law? I mean, for the court's failure to go through those factors? I mean, otherwise, I mean, for our purposes, how can we even review this?
Okay, on the
score. I want to get back to the alleged stipulation, too.
Sure. Concerning the scope, and again, this is the fact that he did not file a motion for post-trial motions for amended findings is significant because that is an opportunity for the district court to flesh out what it intended. So when we have this agreement or statement, I will not call it a stipulation, on the record to pay $2,000 a month at a hearing, combined with the court's determination that Mr. Susan could work in other employment. His disability, you all noted correctly, is specifically to air traffic control. Combined with that piece, and then one of your honors asked about evidence of monthly expenses, for example. Now, this I'm going back through my memory bank, but I reviewed what was submitted at the original trial, which was August 2017. Both parties put in their, you know, your typical evidence of monthly expenses, as I recall. I know for certain Ms. Susan did. At that time, the parties were still living together, had three homes, kind of a mess. A year later, there's still no maintenance determination because the FERS disability determination hadn't been made. When that was made, we all went back to court, and that was the October 2018. Hearing. And at that time, the court invited, we were allowed to submit updated evidence of monthly expenses. So Ms. Susan did. We submitted a sworn statement. Here's what I'm earning now. Here's my monthly expenses, renting, etc. I went back just this morning and reread Mr. Susan's affidavit, and it was submitted at the end of 2018. I'm sorry, I don't have the precise date. And it went through all of his hours and this and that. I saw nothing about here's my current monthly expenses.
Well, could I ask you, who has the burden of submitting
evidence
with regard to the factors?
The party who wants their monthly expenses accounted for, acknowledged, has the burden to submit the evidence. That has been a recurring issue in this case of Mr. Susan selectively sharing what he wants to share and when he wants to share it. And the judge did his best over a year and a half. I want to touch on concerning, and I won't spend too much time on this. In his reply brief for the first time, he asserts his previous counsel was not competent. And that is why he stated on the record he would be willing to pay $2,000. And this goes to the scope piece again.
Well, and I want to get back, because you got back to the $2,000. And here's what bothers me about that, your argument. And remember, we have to write an opinion about this.
Yes, indeed.
We have someone in a contested, looks like a very contested divorce, coming forward and saying, I will pay this much. Mm-hmm. I will settle. This is my settlement offer. Should we adopt your argument that once they come forward and say, I will pay this, that even though the court rejects it and the other party rejects it, that's a baseline? And that therefore the court doesn't have to consider any of the factors in the statute?
No, that is not an ideal situation. I understand this court.
See why I'm concerned?
Yes, I do.
Because I don't want this to be the standard, because I can tell you, that's the standard, no one's ever going to come forward with, I'm going to pay anything. If that's the result. That's what I'm worried about.
Very valid. I get it. And I understand that collectively in this room, we might say this decree is not a work of art. But I will say it was a hard-fought decree over a lot of time. And the reason the agreement on the record or statement, let me call it a statement, I think we just can't ignore it because it might explain what the district court was thinking when he wrote his final decree. And he didn't get a chance to explain that for us because a post-trial motion wasn't filed. I know I sound repetitive on that piece, but I feel this is a disingenuous kind of gotcha to the district court, not allowing the district court judge to have a second swipe. Oh, I did neglect to go through all of the statutes because the factors were set forth in the what was submitted, you know, as proposed. So I understand where Your Honor is going with that, but I would say the district court didn't get that opportunity to flesh it out. And so therefore, the scope, this court's scope is limited to, is the evidence in the record sufficient to support the finding? And yes, it is. It is. Now, a couple of things, and I apologize if I'm getting off track, but there's so many pieces going on here. Yes. Mr. Susan has already filed a motion to modify maintenance. That is at the court below. And the court below said, that's going to be stayed. This is at the Court of Appeals. Same issue. I think the court was absolutely right to do that. So I feel like he's coming at this from both directions. Of course, he has the right to file a motion to modify maintenance, but it's based on the same things we have here.
If we were to agree with you that our scope is limited to whether the evidence in the record is sufficient to support the decision on maintenance, and the argument from husband is I'm rendered, you know, impoverished because of this. What is the evidence in the record that supports the maintenance decision? Well, what is it? And does it include in any way the statement on the record of $2,000? What would you tell us if we were writing an opinion? Yep, this is the evidence we should look at to decide what supports it within that narrow scope of review that you identified.
The evidence in the record is Ms. Susan put in clear evidence of her monthly expenses, and the court made a determination of what she could be earning within 5 years, which we have not appealed, and I believe that's $3,000. She put in all of those expenses. Then the court found that Mr. Susan can work. The court did not make a finding of imputed income, but what is in the record is what he earned when he was a traffic controller, which was, you know, quite a bit more than the $8,000 a month. The $8,000 was his income from the disability in year one. And I apologize that I don't have a whole lot more detail than that, but what came out at one of the hearings was that Mr. Susan was able to, his sister bought one of their homes and he lives there rent-free. These are the bits and pieces that go to the point that he, his monthly expenses drop significantly after phase one of trial.
Okay, if we have to go to the record, what about his allegation that after he pays everything, he's left with about $639 to live on?
Okay, couple of pieces there. Number one, but as of a few months ago, and I don't know where he is now, he was over $30,000 in arrears in maintenance. He just wasn't paying.
He deducted that. He's deducting the monthly payment for the arrears.
Well, I say that because that'll get back to the FERS. Hopefully I'll have time to touch on that. The fact is that the judge expected him to work, and in any capacity.
But usually when the judge expects you to work, they impute income.
Correct.
And I don't know what the judge did here.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can point me to?
I cannot.
Because usually, with pure income, and it's very clear you think he can work.
So
we have the serial judgments and decrees that basically reflect his attempt to get disability and the uncertainty of whether he's going to get it or not get it, and then he finally gets it.
I fully understand.
So there are little inconsistent with the way they're written on that issue.
And again, I stand by the, and I understand my scope argument only goes so far, but the motion for amended findings should have been made. It should have been made. And now we're back.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And I understand that you're correct. Mm-hmm. There should have been a motion for amended findings. Mm-hmm. But what about just the fact that the judge didn't even consider any of the factors?
That is correct. The judge
isn't that
did,
an issue.
I mean,
issue
it's not
of law.
In the
isn't
four.
Isn't that an issue of law, though?
That we can
consider, correct?
The way I interpret it, and I understand there's a blending, arguably, of the stand. I'm going to switch to standard of review. My position is this is an abuse of discretion standard of review because the argument that I hear them making is there was a failure to find certain facts and that certain facts are missing. And so I am categorizing that as an abuse of discretion.
Except in your argument, which I thought was a clever one, but for reasons I stated, where you said that he said, I'm going to pay $2,000 so that excuses the judges from making findings. I mean, literally, there's nothing in this record or in this order that we can tell anything that the judge ever even thought of the factors. I mean, is that a fair? Am I missing something in the order that you can point us
not,
to?
No.
That the judge considered the factors?
No. Nope. Yeah, I mean, there's not anything in the order I can point you to specifically to that question. I see I'm out of time. May I complete?
You may, and I'm sorry we have so many questions. We're obviously engaged in your case. So.
Oh, which I appreciate, and I just wanted to say a quick comment on Furs and Fegley because I hope to. Your Honor's asked the question first of all, he does have to elect disability year after year. Okay, so that's a yearly thing. So we call it the donut hole of Fegley. That's how we all came to understand what happens with this donut hole. And when Ms. Susan could be in trouble, this is the Fegley insurance issue. If he is not receiving FERS disability, and he is not a qualified employee, and he is not eligible for retirement yet. Those three things make the donut hole. In which case, if he were to step in front of the proverbial bus, no benefit to Miss Susan if those three things happen. And that was so clearly in the record and testified to by.
But you'd only need that until 62, right?
When
the retirement benefits kick in, you really don't need it because she's going to be getting part of the retirement.
Once he receives retirement, and, you know, I'm not sure, but that it's that period.
Does the order say anything about that?
Yeah, okay. So,
so here is the other piece
I wanted to say. We all understood, and I do think the order makes clear, that when it converts to retirement and becomes an asset, maintenance stops. There's no double dipping.
I don't know that the order may. I mean, am I missing something? Because I couldn't see where it says maintenance stops. It says permanent maintenance.
Okay. And it's that. And I'm looking at the amended final decree, which is in the addendum of appellant's brief. At the addendum pages are 93 and 94. And you will see under finding 5, retirement interests, and if you skip down from thrift savings plan, you will see the FERS discussion. And this is appellant's addendum at 93. The retirement piece is first, so it's out of order when he that is the asset. If you turn the page, you have the disability language. Any disability pay received by father in lieu of retirement is considered income. So I read that is where we look to where it makes it clear that there's no double dipping. When this turns into retirement, it's an asset. If he is receiving disability pay, it's an income stream. And we understood at trial from the testimony of Brigadier General Joanna Clyborne that those.
Oh, it's Major General now.
Oh, thank you. I knew it was. She was promoted. It was
okay.
Very impressive.
Okay.
Those streams don't cross. You know, once it turns into retirement. I am well over my time. I'm happy to answer any other questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, I'd like to just address really quick the point that was just made by opposing counsel about this idea that the decree provides clarity as to when maintenance would end, when the disability income becomes a retirement asset. It's simply not clear, and it's at odds with their argument that Mr. Susan ought to be imputed some kind of amorphous income that we don't know the amount of. Because if that's true, then what's to prevent a district court from making a finding that when his disability income goes away and he gets a retirement asset division, he's not also imputed employment income after 62. Some people retire at 65. So it's not clear that it's going to end. The other points I want to make really quick, because the court was focused on this, is that I don't know why my predecessor did not file motions for amended findings and post-trial motions following the amended final decree. But that doesn't affect, and it shouldn't affect, this court's ability to review what the district court did under the law. And its failure to make findings under 518.552 is indeed a legal error. And the court always has the ability to review that legal error de novo. Otherwise, we'd be in a situation where the court would be having to codify the district court's failure to make findings simply because my client failed to file a motion for amended findings. And that's just not what the rule says. It's not what the law says. And I wanted to point to respondent's concession, I think, is an important one that the district court didn't make any findings. There's simply not enough in this decree for this court to bless and affirm this maintenance order. There's no findings that this court could hold its hat on in an order to affirm what the district court did here. And we've addressed this actually at the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and we cited this case in our brief in Stitch v. Stitch from 1989. The Supreme Court says, in reversing this court, it said, we've stated on numerous occasions that the standard of review on appeal from a trial court's determination of maintenance is whether that court abused the broad discretion accorded it. Effective appellate review of the exercise of that discretion is possible only when the trial court has issued sufficiently detailed findings of fact to demonstrate its consideration of all relevant statutory factors. And in the Supreme Court further goes on in Stitch v. Stitch that the trial court did make findings with regard to the party's income, but made no findings as to their separate expenses. Moreover, it made no specific finding with regard to obligor's ability to provide maintenance. And so that's exactly what we've got here. We've got this onerous support award that is effectively bankrupting Mr. Susan on a month-to-month basis, and we're supposed to just presume that the district court must have assumed that he could fill the gap with employment without the district court ever saying so, without ever making any kind of analysis, any kind of finding about that factor or any of the other relevant and mandatory statutory factors under 518.552. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I'll yield my time.
Anything further?
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you. We will take the matter under advisement. It was well argued, well briefed, and we appreciate you assisting the court in trying to resolve this matter. Thank you.
Does she need a minute?
Are you okay? Yeah. Oh, yes, thanks. It's passing.
The next matter is St. Paul Refining versus Damier. And the and counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments and let us know who you're representing.